Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu.
I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. We're going to be talking this hour about ticket splitting and what it says about what American voters want. But first, as expected, he did it.
In order to make America great and glorious again, I am tonight announcing my candidacy for President of the United States.
Former President Donald Trump, of course, announcing his third run for the White House last night at his Mar-a-Lago resort in Florida. To say Trump faces some stiff headwinds is an understatement. His challenges include multiple investigations, some of them criminal, some of them related to his efforts to overthrow the results of the 2020 presidential election while sparking a deadly attack on the U.S. Capitol. Members of his own party blame him for significant losses in last week's midterm elections. But in a speech last night, which lasted more than an hour, Trump said voters don't yet realize how bad the situation is in America.
I have no doubt that by 2024, it will sadly be much worse, and they will see much more clearly what happened and what is happening to our country, and the voting will be much different. 2024. Are you getting ready? And I am too. I am too.
Trump's announcement comes 2 years before the next election, 14 months ahead of the New Hampshire primary. What does it mean for the Republican Party still reeling from the midterms? Is America ready for another Trump presidential run? Or are most voters just exhausted and done with Trump? Joining us is Tim Miller. He's the author of Why We Did It, a travelogue from the Republican Road to Hell. He was the communications director for Jeb Bush's 2016 presidential campaign and spokesman for the Republican National Committee during Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign. He's now an analyst at MSNBC and a writer at large for The Bulwark. Tim, great to have you. You're joining us today from Manchester, New Hampshire, and welcome back to On Point. It's really good to have you.
Hey, it's good to be back with you. Good to be back in Manchester.
So here we go again. I think the best troll of the day was a New York Post headline that read, "Florida man makes announcement." I'm wondering what you made of the announcement last night.
Yeah, I guess it's nice to have the New York Post back on board, but they did kind of get us into this mess. I missed the humility step, the apology step between there and trolling him, but we'll take what we can get. I thought it was a weird announcement last night. To put it in the most succinct manner possible. Generally, there's a lot of buildup and excitement for an announcement. Donald Trump didn't even seem particularly excited to be there. It seems like this announcement was based mostly on his petty grievances and wanting to get back at people that he feels had wronged him. The timing was very strange. Carrie Lake had just lost the day before. His, you know, kind of the candidate that ran most in his image, and a lot of candidates ran in his image, but I think the purest essence of Trumpism ran in a swing state of Arizona. They had just announced her defeat the night before. So he certainly wasn't announcing from a position of strength. The venue was also strange, but that's typical of Trump, I guess. His first announcement venue is strange. So I don't think we're in a, you know, obviously, you know, count them out, count your chickens before they've hatched kind of phase. Like we're done with Trump. But he does seem about it as weak politically within the Republican Party as he's been. Maybe since he came down the escalator, maybe since the Access Hollywood tape.
Yeah, and Tim, about the timing, I mean, is it fair to look at the timing as a kind of defensive position more than anything else? I mean, it puts him in a stronger position to counter these multiple investigations arrayed against him. It puts him in a situation where he can possibly try to clear the field and send a statement to other Republicans hoping to vie for the Republican nomination. Is that what we're seeing in terms of him doing it so early, 2 years ahead of Election Day?
Yeah, I would even go a little further and call it desperate, not defensive. Look, it had been a mixed election night for MAGA candidates. I would have seen your argument, right? It's saying, yeah, I want to get in early. It's defensive. Let's protect my turf. Raise the barrier to entry for somebody like Ron DeSantis, right, you know, to wanting to get in. Also, I think he definitely sees this as something that that gives him leverage over DOJ in the investigations. I don't think that's really true, but he thinks it's true. And so I think it is defensive in that sense. But given just how bad, and it was an absolute shellacking. If you were in a swing state or obviously a blue state and you ran on the big lie, you lost across the board. It was a sweep. I did a count for the Bulwark for an article I wrote yesterday for the Bulwark. It was 0-18 in governors and secretary of state's races for people that ran on election denialism, you know, outside of deep red states, right? I don't count Alabama candidate in that, you know, in contested races, 0-18. And so, you know, he is coming from an extremely weak position. And so to me, it feels like he had to announce just to kind of stay above water. And so, I think it's a pretty desperate political situation. Not dead again. We're not counting our chickens, but it's a very weak political position that he's launching from in a way kind of similar to 2016. And maybe he kind of senses that, right? Yeah. That it was a weak political position when he initially launched in 16 and he went on to win.
You know, a number of people have commented about this, but I want to ask you about it. He was very subdued last night. And you know, over the years, from 2016 on, I went to a lot of Trump rallies, specifically in New Hampshire, as well as other parts of the country. Usually, he's a lot different, with a lot more energy, a lot more sort of chest thumping. What was that subdued stance all about? Was that intentional? Was that intentional stagecraft, do you think?
You use subdued. I, you know, as still having some PTSD from 2016 working for Jeb, I might have called it low energy last night.
I'm a tactful guy, Tim.
That's okay. It's public radio. I think that that he felt that there you saw this at times. This was not the only time he's acted like that over the past 7 years. That, you know, feels like 100 that we've had to deal with him. And you know, people get in his ear that you want to be presidential. You know, I noticed one of the commentators on Fox who's you know, kind of in the Trump orbit last night, you know, called it like a State of the Union address. And I think that they got in his ear that you know, in order to reassert himself, you know, in order to be presidential, you know, he should go on teleprompter, you know, and give a serious speech about the state of the nation. I, you know, it's a little reminiscent of the American Carnage State of the Union address, that he gave the beginning of 2017. So to me, that was the calculus. It did not work. It certainly came off as extremely low energy and subdued. And like I said, at the jump, somebody that didn't seem to be very excited to be in the race, but I think that's what was kind of the advice that he was getting.
Yeah. One of the things that I hear a lot from voters when I go out and talk to people, even here in Massachusetts, yeah, I've been in New Hampshire leading up to the midterms, is this word exhaustion with the whole Trump dynamic. I heard that word a lot. Please make it stop. We're exhausted. And in many ways, the midterms seem to be a big vote for normal and away from Trump. Do you agree with that? And to what extent does that represent sort of major headwind for him?
Well, the general election voters, for sure. You know, yeah, I think it remains to be seen what Republican base voters want. So I've also been traveling around. I was in Arizona for the circus on Showtime this past week. And, you know, the crowd at the Kerry Lake events are raucous. Mm-hmm. You know, they loved the show. They loved the trolling, right? And there weren't very few people that showed up to Katie Hobbs events, right? Katie Hobbs wins anyway, right? So I do think that there's this broad middle, you know, kind of this new silent majority. It used to be the Trumpers that said that they were the silent majority, but they've gotten quite loud. You know, kind of a new silent majority of people who just have jobs and lives and want to move on, right? The question is, are there enough of those people who vote in Republican primaries to defeat him, right? Because it absolutely, the more MAGA, the more ostentatious, the more kind of trolly you were as a general election candidate, the worse you did. You know, I'm here at St. Anselm's in New Hampshire where I'm speaking tonight, and I was just looking at the materials for one of the congressional candidates, Caroline, who was, you know, who worked for Trump.
This is Caroline Leavitt, who lost to Chris Pappas, right, in the first district there. And that's a good example of the dynamic, right? I mean, because she was a Trump-backed candidate, Pappas, a Democrat, who was running in a district that where he should have been vulnerable, and he won pretty handily. But I'm sorry, I interrupted.
No. Please note, thank you for giving that contest. This is exactly right. This should have been a winnable district. Yeah. In a wave year, in a midterm year, it's the type of swing district, you know, that Republicans should be able to get. She didn't even finish close, but I was just looking at her materials. You know, it is very Trumpy, you know, and I think that what we learned is that, you know, maybe not a huge swath of the electorate, but an important swing swath of the electorate in New Hampshire and other places said, you know, Chris Sununu, he's a more moderate governor. He was somebody who bucked Trump from time to time, maybe not as much as I would have loved as a never-Trumper, but you know, had a distinct brand. He wins handily. Caroline Leavitt running as a Trump staffer, full MAGA, you know, she loses pretty handily, right? Yeah. So there was enough of these voters in the middle who just said, nope, I'm sick of this. You know, we're ready to move on from this. I might not love everything that Joe Biden and the Democrats have done on the economy, but at least, you know, I can trust that they are not going to completely go in with the crazy. And I think that is a headwind for Trump, as that perception is congeals that, like, his types of candidates can't win.
Well, Tim, you've made this pivot perfectly for me, because I wanted to start the hour talking about Trump because that's big news. But we wanted to sort of get to this idea of the split ticket voter and the significance of that. I mean, we're accustomed to thinking about America as very sort of tribalized in terms of its politics right now, and the split ticket voters seem to be going out of fashion. But you just gave a great example there out of New Hampshire. Did you see other evidence of voters who are like, yeah, I'm comfortable with a moderate Republican, but I'm going to reject the sort of Trump-backed Republican and vote Democrat here? I mean, was there lots of evidence of that in this last election?
Yes, and this used to be common, right? Right. It wouldn't have been something that you'd have to do a segment on. But in each election, each midterm, going back, a couple decades now, fewer and fewer split ticket voters, and this is, you know, referenced in fewer and fewer states having a senator from one party and the other. But when I was in Georgia, the prime example of this, Brian Kemp, you know, he wins handily. Wrote an article about this, and a lot of voters voted for Kemp, Republicans, but said, I can't vote for Herschel Walker. They crossed over and voted for Raphael Warnock, and that's why that Senate race is going into a runoff.
All right, we're going to talk more about this after the break. We're talking about Donald Trump's latest bid for the presidency, takeaways from the midterms, and when we return, the impact of the split ticket voter on the election and why. Tim Miller is my guest. I'm Anthony Brooks. Stay with us. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Later this week, we'll be talking about women in the workforce. In the early months of the pandemic, it looked like there was a mass exodus of women from the labor market. Some even dubbed it a she session. But was there really? And what's happened in the 2 years since then? We want to hear from you. Are you a woman who was laid off or couldn't work early in the pandemic? Are you working now? Did you struggle to keep your job and take care of kids over the past 2 years? Are you a woman who wanted to leave the workforce but couldn't? Give us a call. Tell us your story. The number is 617-353-0683. Again, 617-353-0683. Today, we're talking about Donald Trump's latest bid for president, takeaways from the midterms, and the impact that split ticket voters had on the election and why. We're joined by Tim Miller. He's an analyst for MSNBC and a writer at large for The Bulwark. And Tim, I want to play a little bit of tape here at a rally in Nevada. A month before the midterm elections, former President Donald Trump stumped for the Republican candidates on the ticket. And here's what he said.
But if you want to see great things for our country and the real American dream, and we're bringing it back, you're going to vote Republican up and down the line.
Vote Republican up and down the line. That didn't happen nationally. It didn't happen in Nevada. In fact, Nevada is a good example of where we saw a lot of split-ticket voters, people not voting up and down the ballot for their party. Republican Joe Lombardo won the governor's race there. And then Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto held on to her Senate seat. So, Tim, what happened? Why did we see so many of these split-ticket voters in this election?
Well, I think that basically that there was a group in the center of the electorate that determined that they felt very uncomfortable with two particular issues, the abortion extremism that you saw from certain Republican candidates and the election denialism and anti-democracy extremism. There were other things wrapped up in that, some of the kind of weird positioning and campaigning that some of these candidates made on gender and identity issues, obsessing over, trans sports and litter boxes and classrooms and all this ridiculous nonsense. Right. So just generally, I think that there was a sense of that the candidates were too extreme, and so you saw voters splitting, who that they would go with. A lot of these were people like my folks, that people that had been Republicans who had left the party over Trump. Virginia is a great example of this, right? I think a lot of people were worried in the Democratic Party that the Glenn Youngkin election was this sign that the people, that the working class Obama Trump voters had permanently went to the Republican Party. But the more college educated suburban, Mitt Romney, Biden voters, the never Trumper types, were going back to their old party. Those two groups, ended up really looking at these candidates now and on a candidate by candidate basis. And so you saw a lot of people that voted for Joe Biden in 2020, voted for Glenn Youngkin in 2021, and then maybe voted for Abigail Spanberger, for example, and as a suburban moderate Democrat, in the kind of area between Richmond and Washington, D.C. And so, these voters, are kind of now, these two groups are now mark the new swing voters, and they were happy to split their tickets. I talked to a ton of them in Georgia when I wrote for The Bulwark about the Kemp Warnock phenomenon.
Interesting. Yeah. So is it fair to think about these ticket splitters as moderates by definition?
Yeah, but maybe some of them are not in the moderates in the way that you might think. Some of them might be quite traditionally conservative. They might have been, down the line what you would have thought of as a Reagan or Thatcher conservative, right? But they don't love the anti-democratic stuff of the Trump administration, right? Yeah. They don't love the anti-immigrant elements of the Trump administration. And so they're prioritizing that, over some of their more conservative views. And then in other ways, they might be moderate kind of on the inverse, right? You're talking about a union person that John Fetterman appealed to, right? Like, this would have been a long-time Democrat. Trump appealed to them on kind of cultural grounds, but they never were economically conservative on tax cuts or any of the kind of Reaganomics, right? But they switched parties to Trump. Some of them got clawed back into Fetterman. So those are the two groups. They might both be moderate in the sense that they are heterodox, that they do not agree with all of the positions of the parties, but in a lot of ways, it might be on inverse issues.
Right. So it's a real pushback to the sort of Trumpiness of the Republican Party. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, of the way voting has sort of tribalized under Trump. And I'm thinking of Carrie Lake, for example, out in Arizona, telling John McCain voters to get out. And this seems to be a sort of pushback against that kind of energy on the extreme right of the Republican Party. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, I, for sure. Yeah. And I think that what the Republicans thought, Anthony, right, is that they could maybe get the best of both worlds,
right?
So that they could have somebody that engages in a lot of the Trumpy issues, right, but doesn't do the tweets or doesn't do all the crazies, doesn't do some of his more, idiosyncratic, personal behavior. But voters said no to that. Like there is a significant number of swing voters of independents and of former Republican types that if the candidate even had a sniff of Trump, Trump, they said no to them. And this was true across the board. We did New Hampshire already, Chris Sununu versus Don Bolduc. You know, Sununu wins. In Ohio, Mike DeWine, the gubernatorial candidate, was not seen as Trumpy. J.D. Vance was a hand-picked Trump candidate. Now, they both won, but DeWine won with 13 more points, right, in that governor's race. Across the board, the more the candidates seemed like they were more MAGA, the worse they did with these crossover voters.
Right. I mean, you could look at Pennsylvania, the governor's race. Josh Shapiro, the Democrat, beats the far right Doug Mastriano by 13 points. But the Senate race between Mehmet Oz and John Fetterman, much closer, and the Democrat wins there. Fetterman wins. So let's listen to Lathan Valencia. He's a voter from Los Angeles, said he's a registered Democrat, but feels that his party no longer covers the kitchen table issues he really cares about, such as housing, inflation, and gas prices. So this election, he voted for both. He voted for candidates from both parties.
None of the Democratic Party candidates were actually discussing these table topics. They were actually having further and further discussions to the left that I really didn't see as something that would matter to my vote at this time. Some key races did get my Democratic vote, and other positions actually did get my Republican vote. We need a party that is in the middle.
We need a party that's in the middle. Let me introduce Gary Jacobson. He's a political science professor at the University of California, San Diego, where his research focuses on the electoral basis of partisan polarization in Congress. And Gary Jacobson, great to have you.
Well, thank you for inviting me on.
Well, you've been listening along. I'd love to get your take on sort of the history of split ticket voters. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, over the long history, if you go back to the 19th century, we had very high levels of party line voting. That changed over the course of the 20th century. And then from sort of the 1960s through maybe the early 1990s, ticket splitting was quite common in federal elections. It became less so in this century, to the point where it was extremely uncommon in, say, 2020, where straight ticket voting was on the order of 95% of the voters. In this election, there seems to have been more ticket splitting, but it's not clear that it was a lot of ticket splitting at the federal level. We don't know yet whether people who voted for Republican for the Senate voted Republican for the House and Democrats the same way. So that we have to get the data before we can say that.
Right.
But clearly there was ticket splitting between senator and governor, between governor and the House in a number of these states, having to do with, obviously, the candidates, the specific candidates that were running.
Right. I'm looking at some research from the New York Times and Siena College polling data, which showed that roughly 8% of likely midterm voters, this was before the election this was done, were considering splitting their tickets across Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and Pennsylvania. If that number is correct, 8%, does that represent a significant block of split ticket voters?
It's significant because they can be decisive in these close races.
Yeah,
8% is a small number when you think historically. If you go back, if you look to elections in the 1980s, for example, 8% would be a low figure for ticket splitting, but today it's a fairly high. It's above normal. And of course, since we have a number of closely balanced states, closely balanced parties, that that'll make a difference. And I think it made a difference this time.
All right, let's hear a little more. We put out a solicitation and heard back from some of our listeners. David from Boston called us to tell us that he's been a ticket splitter practically his whole life.
I have been a ticket splitter for about 40 years. I tend to vote Republican in state government elections and Democratic for national government elections. I've lived in Massachusetts and New York for most of the last 35 years, though that combination tends to get me toward a moderate center. The liberals and Democrats in both New York and Massachusetts state government are a bit too far left, and Republicans in national government are too far right.
So David from Boston there, Massachusetts, sort of an interesting case study, very blue state. State government is dominated by Democrats, but Massachusetts voters have been very comfortable with Republican governors for something like 28 out of the last 32 years. And Charlie Baker, the Republican governor, is leaving office and the state has elected a Democrat. But Professor Jacobson, that comment from David. Is that a sort of common view among ticket splitters?
Well, maybe a common view among ticket splitters, but ticket splitters are not that common. He's in a relatively small group. I think the case of Massachusetts, or you think of Kansas now, has reelected a Democratic governor. At the state level, voters are certainly willing to vote across party lines for someone of the other party for governor. It's been that's happened fairly frequently over time, in part because it's a safe vote. If you're in Massachusetts, you know you're going to have a Democratic legislature. You elect a Republican governor, and he's not going to be able to do anything that national Republicans might want to do, because he's got the state legislature to block him. And yet he doesn't carry the baggage that might go along with having majority control for a long period of time. He can keep a kind of check on the legislature. So that can be attractive to a fair number of voters, at least enough to get governors elected who do not necessarily fit the red or blue color of their states. So you have to distinguish in ticket splitting between votes for state offices and votes for federal offices. And it still remains to be seen whether ticket splitting at the federal level is any more common than it was, than it has been in recent elections this right. time around.
Tim Miller, let me bring you back into this. Why does it matter? I mean, we talked about the numbers. They're not very big, 8%. But it seems to me that we're talking about, you know, a potential here, even in a very hyper-partisan era, that the quality of individual candidates clearly still matters, and that at least there's a core of voters who are capable and willing to make that calculation.
Well, it matters because they're a critical, in a polarized country, they're a critical small percentage. Joe Biden is president because of these voters over having a second Donald Trump term. If you looked at the 2020 cycle in many states, Wisconsin is an example, the Republican candidates for House of Representatives and some of these lower level seats did better than Trump, right? So there were people in key swing states that said they voted for Joe Biden, but voted for Republican candidates down the ballot. And they were part of the decide. They weren't entirely, but in a narrow victory, you know, Joe Biden needed, you know, the juiced base turnout, which he got, but he also needed these crossover voters. That is true. You mentioned Nevada, prime example of this. The Senate right now is a Democratic Senate because these crossover voters, you know, thought that Adam Laxalt was too Trumpy. And so they voted for a Republican for governor, but a Democrat for the Senate. So I think it's important just in the practical outcome sense, but it's also important kind of in getting the center to hold in the country. I think there was a lot of concern for a while that both parties were being taken over by the extremes. And there was kind of a real reason for that concern, because in primaries, the more extreme candidates were winning. Well, now, if you are seeing that the more extreme candidates are getting punished in the general election, you know, hopefully that is going to create an incentive structure for, you know, people who are participating in partisan primaries to sort of choose candidates more wisely, choose people that, you know, maybe seem to have more competence, you know, that are less extreme, less inflammatory. You know, we'll see. But I think that kind of overarching message, you know, is an important one.
All right. Well, let's hear from Kim Sanchez. She's from Albuquerque, New Mexico. She's a longtime ticket splitter. She says it's because neither party encompasses all the issues she cares about.
I'm a business owner, so I appreciate less government involvement in business issues. But I also see the Democratic viewpoint of government involvement in social issues as far as common programs that society needs as far as housing, health issues, and whatnot. So I can see both parties having benefits, and so that is why I vote split ticket.
So Gary Jacobson, I'm wondering what we know about who is most likely to be a ticket splitter. Is there any research, for instance, we just heard from Kim Sanchez there in Albuquerque, do women split tickets more than men? Is it white voters, black voters, Hispanic voters? What do we know about that?
I don't know. That is, I haven't looked at any data on this recently. I would guess that what defines ticket splitters is their political opinions, their level of moderation. Presumably, they're moderates, most of them. They're people who, like the person you just talked to, who see neither party as exactly fitting their views. One of the reasons that ticket splitting has declined over the last several decades is that people's political attitudes and their partisanship have lined up more, much more closely. It's why one of the reasons we're polarized. But there's still plenty of voters out there who have divided notions of they like some of the things the Democrats do, they like some of the things Republicans do, and they don't like either side for another less, for other things. So it's those people who have kind of conflicting positions or conflicting preferences that don't fit into the two-party scheme so clearly that are the most likely to split their tickets. But I think demographically, they're likely to be pretty widespread, pretty generally spread. They're not going to be concentrated in one demographic.
All right. So we're talking about some of the key takeaways from the midterm elections. Tim, I'm wondering if you have other ways, just in terms of sort of anecdotal evidence, how do you describe ticket splitters? Do they tend to be men? Do they tend to be women? Are there other ways that you distinguish them?
Yeah, well, no, they are from both parties. There's one group in particular that I think of that has been a ticket splitter of late that has tended to be more men, and that is your kind of suburban, college-educated, mostly white, but really across racial lines, men whose wives, switched and during the Trump era and over Trump and abortion and went hard Democrat, and maybe they had been traditionally Republican. You saw a lot of those types of men saying, for extreme candidates, too Trumpy, too extreme on abortion, I'm going to cross over and vote with my wife on this one. But, I might still vote for a more technocratic, fiscally conservative governor like a Brian Kemp. I talked to a
Tim
lot
Miller,
of guys.
Tim Miller,
stand
like by. We got to take a break. Sorry to jump in. Gary Jacobs from Standby. We're going to do a lot more on this after a short break. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. Today we're talking about takeaways from the midterms and the impact of split ticketing, what the impact was on Election Day and why. We're joined by Gary Jacobson. He's a political science professor at the University of California, San Diego, where his research focuses on the electoral basis of partisan polarization in Congress. Also with us, Tim Miller, who's an analyst for MSNBC and a writer at large for The Bulwark. We've got some comments on Twitter. Kells at Lady KGCT writes, used to split my ticket years ago. Haven't split a ticket since 2008. Republicans have showed who they are. I don't trust them and won't vote for a Republican anytime soon. Tim Miller, I know we have to let you go, and so I'm just going to let you have the last word before you do that, or a last word before you do that. What are you looking forward to in the wake of so much news over the last, since the midterm election, since Trump's announcement, since what comes next? You're up there in New Hampshire, a mere 14 months before the New Hampshire primary. What are you focused on now?
Well, I think that the intra-party fight within the Republicans over the next few months is going to be very interesting. Obviously, the knives are out. My sense is that they are not going to learn the right lessons. I think that you're going to see a lot of folks from the more MAGA Freedom Caucus wing in the House pushing, Kevin McCarthy to do more investigations, be more aggressive on the border, really, kind of follow in Trump's footsteps in a lot of ways. And I think there are going to be other Republicans who, are finally getting off the sidelines. I saw an article from the National Review today saying unmistakably no for Trump, right? So I think that this there was this division within the Republican Party that was underneath the surface because people were too afraid to speak out against Trump or else they would be cast out. And I think that is going to come above surface in the next few months. And it will be interesting to see how that plays out.
Be very interesting indeed. And I look forward to reading your coverage. Tim Miller, he's now an analyst for MSNBC, writer at large for The Bulwark. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it. All right. And still with us is Gary Jacobson. And I want to introduce Neil Levesque. He's the executive director at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. Coincidentally, that's where Tim Miller will be tonight. And Neil Levesque joins us from Manchester, New Hampshire. Neil, it's great to have you.
Well, greetings from New Hampshire.
Yeah. Are you prepared for, well, let me get you, I want to come back to this question.
I know what you're going to say, 2024, right?
2024, and we got some news last night, as the New York Post said, a Florida man made an announcement. Is New Hampshire prepared?
I think we are, and candidates are already coming into the state. They're voting with their feet coming here, and they're, you know, either helping candidates or giving us a preview of what their potential campaigns might look like, and they're not shied away by an announcement yesterday, and so we're seeing a lot of activity already.
Right. So, Neil, as you know, we've been talking about this phenomenon of ticket splitting, and New Hampshire. The reason we wanted to talk to you specifically about that is New Hampshire presents a pretty interesting example of this. So, let me play a little bit of tape. Here's Republican Governor Chris Sununu, who easily won re-election in New Hampshire, but not all Republicans fared so well in that state, and we'll talk about that. But here's what Chris Sununu said about the overall performance of Republicans across the country.
Well, look, quality of candidate matters. It really does, even over policy. Look, I think a lot of people want policy to be fixed, but they're saying, you know what? We can fix policy later. We're going to fix crazy right now. And that was a clear message across this country. Enough of the polarization, enough of the extremism. Let's get back to the basics and deliver me some results.
So we're going to fix crazy right now. Neil, remind us of the dynamic in New Hampshire and how that played out in terms of splitting tickets.
Well, let me set the table by saying that in 2016 and 2020, our four electoral votes, it's a small state, all went to Democrat presidential candidates. So it leans Democratic. And yet we have a governor, Chris Sununu, who was definitely opposed by Trump in his primary, and yet overwhelmingly won that primary and then won again last Tuesday. If there's ever an example nationally of someone who is sort of bucking the trend and winning for Republicans, it's Sununu. And so let's look at what he has done. His messaging and his themes of his campaign are very different than the three Republicans who lost in challenges here in New Hampshire. It's very optimistic. It's sort of a get it done, problem solving a theme that he runs on. And it's not sort of grievances and let's rehash 2020 election. So you have two different Republican themes playing out, one overwhelmingly won here in the state and one lost. And if you look at sort of some of the data, you'll see that the Republican table was set. And so inflation, Biden's popularity, low, wrong track numbers in the close to 70% of people believe the country is on the wrong track. Republicans should have won and they didn't. So what is in the sort of secret sauce that Sununu was doing? And he got 75,000 votes that the Republicans on the ballot for federal office did not receive.
Right, and Neil, I just want to jump in just to be absolutely clear for our listeners. So when you talk about those Republicans who didn't do as well, we're talking about, so basically there were New Hampshire's congressional delegation is entirely Democratic. There was a key Senate race between Maggie Hassan, the Democrat, and Don Bolduc, a Trump-backed Republican. And it was thought that Hassan was might go down to Bolduc, but she won pretty handily against Bolduc. And then the two Congress, Annie Custer and Chris Pappas, the two members of Congress, also fended off Trump-backed candidates pretty handily as well. And yet, this very popular Republican Governor Chris Sununu wins re-election. So great example there of a lot of people splitting tickets.
Absolutely. So the big question here is parties exist to win. That's the only reason they exist. Yeah. And if the Republican Party isn't winning, how does it have to evolve? And so you asked Tim earlier, what are you looking towards the future?
Yeah.
So we saw this announcement last night. So Trump is going to really dominate, I think, a lot of the political conversation on the Republican side. But what else is going to happen? So yesterday, McCarthy was close to basically getting this 218 number that he needs. Keep in mind that in order to become speaker, you need 218 votes. If one Republican votes present, as we saw in 1997 with the Gingrich race, he doesn't become speaker. So he has to sort of cater to that entire caucus. He can't lose one. And so that means that people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, for example, they may say, we want these themes to come out of your speakership. And so if we have a Republican Party with Trump and Speaker McCarthy sort of not looking at the tea leaves from last Tuesday, the party is not necessarily going to change overnight.
Mm-hmm. So Gary Jacobson is, finding a way to encourage more people, I guess, to split their tickets. Is that a way to, help the party engage more in a sense? I mean, what's your view? Respond to what Neil Levesque is saying.
Well, I think parties want to win elections. In recent years, they've sought to win elections largely by mobilizing their base. In a very closely balanced, highly polarized electorate, getting your people to the polls is absolutely crucial. And that leads to a focus on the party's favorite themes that don't have a lot of cross-party appeal. If they lose doing that enough, then their incentive will be, okay, we can't just rely on mobilizing the base. We have to have at least some cross-party appeal. And with that incentive, then presumably, if they actually want to win elections, they'll be more inclined to moderate their positions or to take positions that people in the other party, independent voters, of which there are some, find attractive. And that one of the things that is a possibility for mitigating the level of polarization that we've seen in recent decades.
Right. Let me ask you both this. To what extent does the entrance of Donald Trump back into presidential politics encourage or discourage more ticket splitting? Gary, we've been talking about how, it's a relatively small number of voters. It could be a key number of voters. But do you think that number grows with Trump back in the race for president, or stays the same, or diminishes? What's your feeling?
Well, I think it grows because he has a way of generating very strong opinions, and there is a faction of his own party that is not enamored of him. I looked at some data from this morning from the Economist YouGov poll, and something on the order of 20% of Republicans have a negative view of him, and that number is higher than it's been over the last few months. And those are the people who are at least susceptible to crossover voting at the presidential level. Trump is a highly polarizing individual, and he splits his party to some degree. That is, he's very popular on the whole still, but yet there are detractors within the party who are willing to desert him in an election. So I think if he's on the ballot, you'll get more ticket splitting than, say, if Ron DeSantis is on the ballot.
Interesting. Neil, what do you think?
There's one other interesting thing from that your listeners might be interested in, and that is they asked the question, who would you vote for, DeSantis or Trump? And among Republicans, DeSantis wins pretty decisively in this particular poll. He gets 49% or 46% to Trump's 39%. And that's unusual. Been following these polls for some time, and usually Trump has a real lead over DeSantis when they match them up. This time, not. So there may be some fallout from the 2022 results that have kind of tarnished Trump's image among his own party.
Right. Neil Levesque, chime in on this. To what extent do you think Donald Trump's entrance into the presidential race encourages or discourages more ticket splitting? And talk specifically about a key primary state like New Hampshire.
I think it's going to encourage more ticket splitting. And I think elections are about the future. And if you watched the speech last night, It was generally about previous elections. It was a speech he could have given in 2020. It wasn't really about the future. But here's the problem for Republicans. With Trump in the race, he is very popular amongst a segment of Republicans, a large segment. And it's not as if he's going to yield to another candidate just because they have similar themes or they live in the same state. He's not going to do that. So he's a problem as well as a benefit is getting that base out during a general segment of the population that's sort of fed up with that segment of the Republican Party. And I think the evidence is clear from last Tuesday. And so I think Trump's entrance will continue to sort of be unpalatable to a certain amount of general election voters.
All right, I'm going to play another bit of reaction here to the last election. Charlie Baker is the outgoing two-time Republican governor of Massachusetts. He did not run for re-election. Maura Healey, a Democrat, won the election last week. She will be the state's first female governor, as well as the first openly gay governor of Massachusetts. But here's Baker talking to CNN. He said the midterm elections demonstrated, especially in battleground states, that voters aren't interested in extremism.
They want people who they believe are going to be reasonable, who are going to be collaborative, and who represent sort of the fundamental tenet of democracy, that it's supposed to be a distributed decision-making model, and you're supposed to be okay with that. And I think in the midterms, one of the big lessons that the Republican Party nationally needs to take away from it is voters want collaborative elected officials. They don't want extremes.
That's Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker. Neil Levesque, I want to come back to you for one more question about ticket splitting, at least one more question if we've got time. One of the things that's always intrigued me about New Hampshire, you mentioned at the beginning of this segment that it's, you know, basically a Democratic state. I think it's fair to call it purplish, but trending Democratic. Its entire congressional delegation is Democratic, but you've got a state legislature entirely controlled entirely by Republicans. That seems to me also an example of ticket splitting, splitting between federal races and local races.
Absolutely. And the number of Republicans went down, even though, again, Sununu won with this large number. Some of these races are being decided right now by one and two votes in recounts. Hmm. That's right. One vote decided a race this week in the New Hampshire State House. So it's different. And as far as Charlie Baker goes, he is the most popular governor in America. And yet he chose not to run for re-election. And a lot of people speculate because he could not win a Republican primary dominated by sort of these Trump-themed party officials. So
that's right.
That's an amazing situation if you think about it.
Yep. And we should point out to listeners who don't know, Baker didn't run. A Trump-backed Republican named Jeff Diehl did run. He won the nomination. He had the backing of the Trump wing of the Republican Party in Massachusetts, and he got absolutely clobbered by the Democrat by a 2-1 margin, Maura Healey. So there's an example of that. Gary Jacobson, let me ask you about that situation in New Hampshire. Is that pretty typical when it comes to ticket splitting? That is, voters going one way on federal races and another way on state races?
It's not exactly typical, but it happens relatively frequently, much more than you see going different directions, for example, in the House and the Senate races and the presidential races. There are quite a few states that have legislatures and governors of not the same legislature. You get split control between the governor and the legislature in terms of a partisan control. That's not particularly uncommon. Part of it has to do with, again, this notion that if you're in a very blue or very red state, it's safe to elect a governor from the other side because he's not going to be able to do things that are you're going to find terribly obnoxious.
Right.
All
right. Sorry to jump in there, Gary. We are up against the clock, but I really appreciate having you. Gary Jacobson, a political science professor at the University of California, San Diego. His research focuses on the electoral basis of partisan polarization in Congress. Thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it, Gary.
You're welcome.
And Neil Levesque, Executive Director at the New Hampshire Institute of Politics at St. Anselm College. He joined us from Manchester. Neil, always good to talk to you, and I'll see you out there on the campaign trail in the weeks and months ahead.
Sounds good. Thank you, Anthony.
All right. Thank you, listeners, for joining us. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.